And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning, Mark Sunday, who's the Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President at Oracle. He's responsible for providing global communications, computing, security infrastructure that enables Oracle's internal business operations, as well as a variety of hosting and educational services for Oracle customers. Oracle's a $38 billion company headquartered in Redwood, California. We look forward to our conversation with Mark, who makes his home in Park City and commutes to Oracle facilities around the world.
And good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our second guest this morning is Paul Halpern. He's written a book called Einstein's Dice and Schrodinger's Cat, How Two Men Battled to Create a Unified Theory of Physics. 101 years ago, Einstein presented the tenets of general relativity. 10 years later, Erwin Schrodinger's presented the equation of quantum theory. These equations remain today at the core of our understanding of fundamental physics. In Einstein's Dice and Schrodinger's Cat, physicist Paul Halpern takes us through the relationship between the two men. Sometimes they collaborated, sometimes not.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning, Mark Sunday, who's the Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President at Oracle. If you're not familiar with this Silicon Valley company, well, they have annual sales of $38 billion and a market cap of $160 billion. And more successfully and effectively than any other company I know, they have moved their product offering to cloud-based platforms. Mark Sunday, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, delighted to have you here. Maybe first we can start and you can tell us about what a CIO, a Chief Information Officer's responsibility is at Oracle.
Well, so first of all, Chief Information Officers, their job is one of making their organization more effective, whether it's all the employees, the ecosystem, customers, as well as ensuring security and privacy across all the things that they do, and doing so effectively. So not only that their lines of business, functions, geographies, but every employee in the organization is effective as possible. That said, though, it takes on a different role or an additional role at Oracle in that because we are the broadest implementation of Oracle technology anywhere in the world, we like to think of ourselves as the biggest influencer for what can be done with our products to make them better, faster, easier to operate, easier to maintain. Be first adopter, you know, after we're successful at influencing them, take those products and turn the lights on first with them, and everything goes well, be the best promoter of our products. So CIOs everywhere about making their organizations more effective. At Oracle, we also have the additional role of making our products more effective.
And in addition to driving your internal business, the large data centers that you have around the world that you provide for the cloud-based platforms, are you responsible for those as well?
Well, I was responsible for the launch of our biggest data center in the world, which is in West Valley. But when we acquired Sun Microsystems and we looked at all the data center capacity required for our internal uses, as well as our cloud and development and other lines of business, one of the things I think we did was strategically is we took data center to look like real estate and put our part of our real estate organization responsible for being effectively the landlord for anyone around the world at Oracle that needs compute capacity, whether it's stuff that we own or stuff that we get from somebody else via colo facilities.
Mark, could you talk a little bit about your biggest asset in West Valley?
Oh, our data center there, we bought 55 acres of land, and with the concept of let's make something that can grow to the scale that, quite frankly, within this geography space, you know, it could grow as large as we ever needed it to be. So we're right on the power grid as it heads out to the mine, which is, you know, that's one of the most important aspects of choosing where you put a data center is access and what the cost of power is. In fact, our locations turned out to be, you know, incredibly work well for us that eBay is essentially kitty corner from us with their global facility. And of course, Twitter and then, you know, NSA is just south of us down the road. So the whole West Valley, the whole Salt Lake Valley has actually become quite the place for some big data centers.
Very interesting. And for those of our listeners who may be from out of town, West Valley City is just as it sounds. It's in the West Valley of Salt Lake City, just heading west towards along I-80, if you were heading west on I-80. So, could you talk a little bit about that? You just sort of, you mentioned several companies that have big data centers in Salt Lake, and if Oracle's was the first, what is it that attracted you to Salt Lake as a company?
Well, I'd have to back up quite a ways, if you don't mind. How I first came to Salt Lake was I was the CIO at Siebel Systems, working for Tom Siebel. And I was presenting to him in 2001 what the impact of the rolling blackouts would be that we were having in California. And Tom rolled back in his chair, you know, the infrastructure in California is going to get worse before it gets better. It's very expensive. Why are we the, you know, last big California company to have all of its operations here? So we decided to start moving some things, and I moved a call center, and within 2 months, 12 days, we were up live in Salt Lake, and it was a huge success. Not only did we have a really competent workforce that we hired, they were actually nice. And so, you know, we had just such a good experience. But then 9/11 hit, and Tom rolled back in his chair and said, Mark, you know, if what happened in New York happened here in California, we'd be in kind of serious issue. I want to be able to run, you know, this company from anywhere. And we ought to have our computing not dependent on just one place. So I looked at the usual suspects for data centers, which at the time was Dallas, Denver, Phoenix. But we had such a good experience with the Economic Development Corporation of Utah and Jeff Edwards and team. We said, well, let's look at here as well. And so they showed us a couple of data centers and the 9/11, of course. 2 months later, we announced we're building moving into a couple of match data centers here in Salt Lake. And it grew from there. We were acquired by Oracle. And when we needed to build, you know, really a monster of a place, this was the natural place to do it.
Wow. Since 2010, Oracle has acquired on average 8 companies per year, including some big guys like Sun and NetSuite. How do you take these different IT organizations and ways of doing business and also cultures, and how do you assimilate those into the Oracle family?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. It's something that I get to talk about a lot. So first of all, you know, being an IT guy, kind of my premise to effective IT is this whole thing of freedom from choice. The more you can make things the same, the faster I think you can go, the easier it is to change to something else. So historically, we had been with acquisitions. We're the Borg. You will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. We don't integrate, we eliminate kind of thing. But that said, a few things that we do that I really, really like is we're a California company. So I ask each of my staff, and right now we're just starting the assimilation process with NetSuite. I ask each of my staff that's engaged, you know, think of yourself as a prospector. I don't want to hear about all the rock you find. I want to hear what those nuggets of gold are. What do they do that's better than us? Who do they have that would really complement our team? What do they do? What processes that we can not only retain for NetSuite or Sun or Siebel or Hyperion or any of these other organizations, but we make the standard across everything that we do? And so that process has really worked out well. In fact, even if you just look at people, if you take myself and my direct staff, 7 of the 10 of us actually came in from one of the acquisitions. It's been not only, you know, I think it's a challenge, but far more accretive that the value that we've gained from learnings from each of these acquisitions we've made over the years.
So acquisitions are certainly very important, but on even on a broader scale, how does Oracle evaluate and choose technology? I know as a sales executive with my sales teams, we were constantly calling on or trying to get to CIOs of major companies to talk about our products relative to the competition, to get evaluations going, those sorts of things. And I always looked at a CIO's job, as I called on CIOs for many years, as a just a real challenging job, because there's this sea of madness out there. There's a lot of rhetoric out there, but there's also some tremendous, really good products. So how do you all do that?
Well, from an IT perspective, you know, we have a big advantage that we don't go off and evaluate a lot of other companies' products. So, you know, as I mentioned early on, freedom from choice is one of the best enablers for effective IT. You know, it's pretty darn sure we're going to implement Oracle technology. But that said, we have access, I'd argue, the biggest quiver of technology areas of any IT organization in the world, because my team has everything that Oracle's ever built, everything that we've ever bought, and if it's software, we have it for free. And so we have a plethora of really, you know, excellent technologies. But then we complement it with things that we, you know, leverage from others as well. And one advantage that we have with Oracle is, first of all, our size. My team's in 50 countries as well. So I have people that are out hearing, listening to things all the time. But the second aspect of size, we get approached by everyone. Whether it's the small startups with the latest innovative idea, or we get put in front of the best and brightest from some of the biggest technology suppliers in the world, you wanting to be part of our ecosystem. So it's a wide variety of things. In fact, technology doesn't begin and end with my staff or reaching out to our suppliers. In fact, my older son, Jake, who's 16, scheduled me to go get an Oculus Rift demo this evening at 7. He goes, "Mark, you have to see this." "Dad, excuse me, you have to see this." Having two teenage sons exposes you to a lot of technology as well.
So I was calling on the wrong people. I should have been calling on their children.
It seems so. I mean, you know, that's an interesting thing actually about the acquisitions, though. It used to be that all of our learnings really came from the big guys. You know, as you mentioned, Sun and Sun and Siebel and Hyperion, Jade Edwards, all these big ones. But much more recently, these young cloud companies that we've acquired, they are doing some incredibly fascinating things. And so we're learning how we can uplift all of Oracle by seeing what these 20-person cloud company that, you know, average age is 24 and had the bring the dog to work policies.
Yes, the culture in those small companies, you see it online from time to time. You see people with their dogs, like you say. You see them playing ping pong, and it looks like a great culture. Talk, if you would, about a couple of those, you know, your favorite little cloud companies that you've acquired that, you know, that have fewer than 50 people working there.
Well, I just, about a month ago, was visiting one that's become part of our Oracle Data Cloud service out of north of Denver. And what they do is data as a service. So their job is to take data from all the buying that occurs online, all the buying that occurs, in brick and mortar, and pull that all together. And they've identified like 5 billion of the 7 billion people on the planet, you know, all these characteristics, of course, keeping the privacy, but nonetheless can provide that information. So they're dealing with unbelievable volumes of data. Yet you walk into their office area, first thing you notice is a big CrossFit gym, you know, kind of in the middle. Then the next thing you notice is there aren't any offices, that everything is just an open space and everyone's working at a different level. Some people are standing up, others are sitting down. There's no concept of wires. Everything's wireless around the whole place. And even the way of communicating and collaborating is very dynamic, much different, and sometimes a little bit challenging for a big company like Oracle, that we have really significant security concerns. We go into some of these places, our heads spin around a little bit, but there's really incredible learnings. And so I think it's changing the way how we communicate and collaborate.
Absolutely. I want to make sure I get a chance to ask you, you know, we talked about the Salt Lake Valley. You are a Park City resident. That is when you're not commuting to the various reaches of the globe. Why Park City? You've got two sons and they both go to school in the area. So I know why Park City, but is it the same reason for you?
Yeah, we moved here, you know, the common thing, come for the winter, stay for the summer. But in our particular case, you know, we had a one-year-old son, and my wife was pregnant with a child 6 months old, and we had been invited by, you know, Mike Leavitt out for the Olympics, you know, because we had just announced our data center. But we are also invited by the governor's office to come out. Well, next time you come during the summer to look on your data centers, bring your family. Well, again, my wife had a one-year-old and 6 months pregnant. I get home from work on Friday. She pulls out this brochure with all these homes. You know, Mark, I went and looked at this stuff today. Houses weren't one half the cost. They're 50% of the cost. And we had been sharing a home with my sister in Lake Tahoe and commuting back up from our Redwood City home. So go to a single house where we could ski and at one-fifth the cost. I mean, what's not to love? But since we moved here, you know, I was mentioning to JW earlier that I thought it would be like moving to Fiji, a great place to live, but your professional network would end. I'm finding that absolutely opposite. There's so much going on here in Park City. And I've, you know, gotten so connected. You know, I'm on the Board of Trustees of Utah Technology Council. I'm on the board of the Leonardo, you know, actively involved. I'm one of the judges with Utah Innovation Awards. And so it's so easy to get connected and keep relevant and do interesting things. But once again, you know, we moved here largely for skiing, but it could stay summer year-round, I think, as far as my wife and I are concerned.
I'm with you.
It's a brave new world, and security is obviously a tremendous concern for Oracle. Give us your perspective on security at Oracle, and how do you handle security at home with your kids?
So, you know, this is my 11th year as CIO at Oracle. I can't even begin to measure the sophistication we've added to our security and privacy across everything that we do. But that said, the threats have been growing, you know, very much at an equal rate. And so we, year on year, probably increase within my organization security budget by 30-35%. It's by far the fastest growing to try to stay on top of these incredibly sophisticated threats. So it's a very, very big area of concern. But you had talked early on about cloud computing. Historically, cloud computing's been one reason why organizations were concerned. You know, security was one reason why organizations were concerned about going to the cloud. My belief in the future is it'll be one of the big drivers why people, in fact, implement cloud solutions, because the scale and competency and resources it takes to really deal with today's threats. And then relative to home, you know, I mentioned to you off air that I'm building a new home. And so the things that, you know, I'm doing relative to it is, you know, the protection, internet protection is very, very important. You know, and so building in the technologies with the appropriate screens to on content and so forth, I think is absolute requirement. Every, you know, family with young children or teenagers should be doing it. Things like OpenDNS are great at being able to do content filtering. And then, I'm fortunate that I'm surrounded by some pretty interesting tech guys. So we're doing some kind of fascinating things from authorization, authentication, access to the house, and so forth. But I do think that every parent, though, should make sure that they're doing something relative to content protection.
One of the common themes of Cool Science Radio is STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics for kids, and probably a little bit of an emphasis at Cool Science Radio for STEM education for girls. I understand that you're also very interested in STEM and the importance of doing a better job in K-12. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my passions. In fact, some of you might be aware, we have this big thing here in Utah called STEM Fest, where over 20,000 middle schoolers get exposed over 3 days to STEM technology. So companies come in and show this is what it's like to have a STEM career. So last year, Oracle, with 60 volunteers, trained over 2,000 kids on programming in the language Alice. You know, the governor came by and so forth. And that's just one step, but on much, much broader. At Oracle, we have what's called Oracle Academy, and we provide, at no cost, in fact, we train the teachers as well, the complete curriculum from K through 12 into colleges as well as universities on how to teach computer science, because I think it should be math, science, English, and computer science. It should be core, the whole critical thinking and everything that you get out of it. And so it's a tremendous opportunity in terms of interesting careers, in terms of the high growth, growing twice as fast as everything else, well paid. But one thing that I had an opportunity to talk to guidance counselors recently, and I went and looked at the USA Today survey about what are the happiest careers. 7 of the 10 happiest careers were ones that were technology-based. And so while you make more, there's more jobs, but perhaps even more importantly to me is it's something that you like doing. One other quick thing I want to mention is that, my boys, when they're younger, they're sitting with their headphones on, they're collaborating, doing Minecraft, and I was really looking at what they're doing, and that's not a whole lot different than 1,000 people working for me do every single day. So, I think the jobs, it's great that there's a lot of them. It's great that they pay well. But I think it's actually fun. And so getting more and more kids into technology, because it is the biggest need in terms of skills that we have here in Utah.
Yeah, especially, well, let me ask you this. I was going to say, especially in cybersecurity, it seems, but if you were to advise your kids, they're a little shy of college age, but getting there, if you're going into a computer science related area of study, what do you think is the most important? I mean, the whole industry changes so quickly, and it's hard for universities to keep up with that.
No, so I think what they need to do is just start with kind of the basic programming skills. I mean, just put a kid in front of Scratch, or like we were doing at STEMFest, we were introducing them to this programming language, Alice, where they dynamically create these environments. They're learning by doing this of how to like problem solve and do critical thinking, all these fundamental core skills. It doesn't matter the details of the technology, which programming language it is. They're learning the concepts that then they can take into specialized skills, whether it be telecommunications, security, operating systems, application development. But those core skills that they learn, one thing I really want to emphasize, this is not just for computer scientists. If you want to be a landscape architect, you need to know technology. If you want to be involved with any sort of the creative arts, you need to understand technology. These are skills that are applicable effectively across, I think, most every professional area.
Mm, that's a great answer. I wanted to ask you before we have to let you go, you've talked about, these small companies that Oracle has acquired. You've talked about innovation. You've talked about how your role is to streamline and make your company more effective. But I'm wondering, with a $38 billion company, Oracle is huge. What are some of the challenges that you have as to be such a large company? What would you prefer in terms of tools that you could have if you were a smaller company?
Well, one of the things we have is we do have scale, but we also have huge responsibility. Was it that Peter Parker's uncle said that with great power comes great responsibility? We are responsible for the core information assets of companies of public sector, on a global basis. So the level of rigor we have to put around things is certainly much more than you'd have in a young, nimble company, but it's our responsibility to do so. That said, with our scale, and as long as we can keep the vision moving forward, we can do so. We have scale to be very creative, very inventive. And perhaps the best asset we have is, our co-founder, Larry Ellison, who's still the technology visionary for our company, of making sure we have a culture of constantly reinventing, constantly innovating, constantly taking advantage of what we do. Now, if I was doing a startup, you know, I would want all 10 guys in a room. I'd leave a gap under the door so I could slide pizza in and want them to innovate. But, you know, at our scale, that's not pragmatic. So my team is in over 50 countries. And so what we do is, what can we do to make that challenge actually a tremendous opportunity? So first thing, it allows us, because we have the culture, process, and technology, we can hire the best person for a job anywhere in the world. The guy who owns designing all the network infrastructure for Oracle lives on a beach in Perth, Australia. You know, so we're capable to do that. The second big thing is, you take this big thing of being big and turning it into an opportunity, is we can move work products forward 24 hours a day. You know, I have a big base in Bangalore, in Bucharest, and in here in this hemisphere, in places like Guadalajara, as well as the United States. 24 hours a day, work products are being moved forward. So you take the disadvantages of being big to turning them to advantages.
Speaking of Larry Ellison, I'm not familiar with any other Fortune 500 company who has a chairman who is also the chief technical officer. Maybe there is one. I'm not familiar with any.
There's not an equivalent to Larry.
There is not an equivalent to Larry, although a lot of people would like to be Larry. That's for sure.
No, Larry's doing amazing things, not only with Oracle, but he reinvented sailing, America's Cup. It's unbelievably exciting. We'll be doing that in Bermuda. These boats will hit 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Until very recently, faster than any boat in the U.S. Navy. He's changed professional tennis with what he's done with Indian Wells. He's changing the whole landscape of what you're doing in Lanai, of really making a self-sustaining ecosystem on a wide variety of things. So Larry's not only been the driver behind our company, but really making things happen in a lot of different areas.
And he almost bought Apple.
Steve Jobs was his best friend.
And he did the eulogy at Steve's funeral. Yeah.
Yep.
Amazing. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. Mark Sunday, who is the Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer, also very supportive of technology in the state of Utah, on the Technology Council, and of course on the board at the Leonardo, and also a big proponent of STEM education K-12. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay.
Great to have you, especially you gave up, 35 minutes now of time you could be skiing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. We shall return right after these messages. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features three bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Hi, this is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, longtime supporters of KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers custom picture framing, rush options, hanging and delivery services, and in-house designers. Open Monday through Saturday, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Mark Sunday, who is the Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President at Oracle. Great conversation with him. Our next guest is Paul Halpern. He's written a new book called Einstein's Dice and Schrödinger's Cat: How Two Men Battled to Create a Unified Theory of Physics. Quantum mechanics tells us the universe operates randomly. Einstein, who brought us general relativity, once said, "God does not play dice with the universe." Schrödinger presented a bizarre thought experiment where a cat could be neither dead or alive in the quantum world. Halpern's book is about all that and the relationship between these two men, Einstein and Schrödinger. Paul Halpern joins us by phone. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on the show. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
Great.
It's great to have you. Well, I have to tell you that just yesterday, this book was sitting on our table, and my two college-age sons, who are home for the holidays, saw it, and they said, "Oh, Mom, surely you don't know what Schrödinger's cat is." And I said, well, of course, it explains quantum theory, and it's about the cat that's neither dead nor alive, or dead and alive at the same time. And they laughed. And what was really great about it is a wonderful argument ensued between the two about what it really means. So why don't we start back? I know you're a professor, and so you explain this in very layman's terms, I'm sure, to your students. Let's go back to this. What is Schrödinger's cat?
Well, it was very interesting because Einstein and Schrödinger both had some doubts about quantum theory. They believed that quantum theory worked, but they both thought that it was incomplete. And the reason they thought it was incomplete was because Einstein believed that the universe should be deterministic, meaning like running like a clock, that once it's wound up, it should just keep going. And he didn't like the idea of chance in quantum physics, which is why he said God does not play dice. Mm. And Schrödinger didn't like the idea that quantum physics could connect things that are very distant, which is called entanglement, that two things that could be seemingly unrelated could be connected so that if you change one, the other immediately changes. And he thought that was a bit perplexing and was a weakness of quantum physics that should be corrected. And that's why Schrödinger came up with the cat experiment, which was a thought experiment that he never intended to be carried out. So cat lovers, don't worry. He wasn't really intending that to be a real experiment. He thought it was a bit of a parody or critique of quantum physics, showing the absurdity of the standard view of quantum physics, showing the idea that two things, especially one from the real world, the mundane world, and something subatomic could be connected is rather absurd. And that's why he picked a cat and a decaying particle in a box and connected them in a way so that if something happened to one of them, the other would be affected, and sealed it in a box and said, okay, well, because the decaying particle would be in a mixed state until it's measured, a mixed state of decayed and undecayed, the cat would be in a strange zombie-like state of being alive and dead until you opened the box and observed it.
That's good. So he helped explain portions of Einstein's theory of relativity that Einstein wasn't able to explain. I guess that's saying it in sort of simple terms. But my question is, why do most of us not know about Schrödinger, yet Einstein is a household name, of course?
Well, Einstein in his lifetime was considered almost a prophet because of his discovery of the idea that light can be bent by stars, which was one of the predictions of relativity. And as soon as they discovered back in 1919 that during a solar eclipse that starlight could be bent and that a star could appear in a different place in the sky than normal during a solar eclipse, everybody thought, wow, he did some kind of magic. He took the stars and actually shook them up. And they thought of Einstein as a bit like a prophet, a bit like a sage. And then from that point on, and also because of his appearance and because of his attitude, people thought of him as someone they could look up to, ask questions. Throughout his lifetime, he was always being hounded with questions from children to reporters, and everybody wanted to know what Einstein's view was on things. Schrödinger, in contrast, was never really well known except in Ireland during the war, which is where he went into exile, and there he was a celebrity, but not really internationally.
So in the 1960s, before social media and all that, when John Lennon or Paul McCartney would speak, people seemed to listen. And it kind of seems the same in this situation where Einstein and in some respects Schrödinger were treated like rock stars. Schrödinger was a sort of a wannabe, as he would always quote his conversations with Einstein. I think it appeared that he was looking for more notoriety. But Einstein was treated like a rock star, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Einstein was one of the most famous people in the world, and he was looked at much in the same way, as you mentioned, as the Beatles were in the 1960s. People wanted to know his views on everything, and sometimes he would stir up controversy, as did John Lennon sometimes in the 60s, because Einstein spoke his mind. He was very direct, and he would criticize things, and then people would say, oh, my gosh, Einstein said this. And they would get upset because they looked up to him so much. Schrödinger was kind of an Einstein wannabe, especially when he went into exile during World War II in Ireland. And there, because Ireland was rebuilding itself, they wanted him to be the Irish answer to Einstein, even though he was Austrian and not Irish, but he was living in Ireland, and he was their Nobel Prize winner. And they were hoping that he would make a breakthrough similar to Einstein. And that was the pressure he was under, which is why about 70 years ago, he declared that he beat Einstein to a theory of everything. That was in January 1947. He said, I beat Einstein to a theory that he was working on for 30 years, but I came up with the answer myself. And that created international headlines.
Yeah, so 101 years ago, Einstein comes up with the beginnings, the basic tenets of general relativity, which is the large and the very far apart, like galaxies and star systems. And then 10 years later, Schrödinger comes up with the very beginnings, the early equations of quantum, which is the small and the very close together and the bizarre. And then they both start working on this unified theory. I just have a fundamental question. What are the possible practical applications that would come out of a true unified theory? What good would come from this? Why all the hoopla?
Well, of course, it's an intellectual exercise. People want to think of the universe as unified. They want to think of nature as something that comes from a fundamental unity. But in terms of practical things, we really don't know. For example, in 1905, Einstein proposed the photoelectric effect, saying that if you shoot photons at materials, they can release electrons. And people thought of that as an abstraction. But today's digital cameras and phone cameras and so forth depend on that technology, which Einstein never really anticipated. So you never know what types of new technology could come from a genuine unified field theory.
Okay. So my question is this. It seems as though some in the hard sciences want to shy away from quantum theory, and you find people in the more esoteric, shall we say, of fields embracing quantum theory and quantum physics. Can you offer a suggestion as to why that might be?
Well, I think most people in the hard sciences accept the results of quantum physics. And they say, well, okay, if there are funny things about it, like if you take an observation that there's a certain amount of chance and the observation might affect the measurement, they might say, well, that's a little bit strange, but it works. And people in the more practical sides of the sciences are looking at what works. On the other hand, people who are looking at fundamental issues in physics, and there are many people exploring quantum philosophy and quantum measurement, say, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's a better way of explaining it than to say that a human observer taking a measurement can affect the outcome.
All right. You have written, maybe this is your 13th book, maybe it's your 14th book, but a lot of books on popular science. And maybe you could talk about, you know, what you're trying to do as both a professor and an author of books on popular science. You know, what you're trying to do, you're trying to bring it to the masses? Are you, and then how do you decide on themes and topics for your books?
Well, I think science education is becoming more and more important in our society. Our society is becoming increasingly technological, And it's important for people to understand the science behind it and what we're spending, for example, government money on or private money on. People should be educated to that. Also, I like to tap into a genuine sense of wonder, which I think many children have. They wonder about the universe, you know, what if, you know, what is the are the limits of things, the frontiers of space. And there's so many questions. When I speak to children, I get so many interesting questions about the universe and about time travel and all sorts of things that people wonder about. And I really get thrilled when people read one of my books and find that that it answers some of their questions and maybe even raises other questions. I like to write things that are intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, and we've been studying the light side of the universe, you know, what's observable to the human eye for 5,000 years. And a comment about children, I love their curiosity. I wish more people would look up like they used to. They don't look up in the sky like they used to. Everybody's looking down at their smartphones. But we've been looking at the light side of the universe for so many years. And then only recently, we've opened up windows in the X-ray and the radio, and we've seen a totally different universe. Now, since last year's LIGO discovery of gravitational waves, we're going to, for the first time over the next 50 years, be able to take a peek at the universe, at the dark side of the universe through the gravitational lens, and that's very, very exciting. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that's something that motivated Einstein. He was interested in the idea of gravitational waves. He kind of went back and forth in his lifetime about that, but eventually he published a paper in 1936 predicting gravitational waves. And I think it's very exciting that the idea was finally proven last year, definitively proven, and it opens up a new avenue for exploring the universe because light is only one modality, one form of radiation, but the universe is also full of gravitational radiation, and gravitational radiation can reach backward in time even further, even closer to the Big Bang, because, for example, we can only see with light about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, whereas gravitational waves can reach back even further.
And the dark side comprises what they believe to be 96% of the universe, and this is an area that we basically do not know anything or very, very little about. So there's a tremendous upside there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's really stunning and humbling how much of the universe we really don't know about. So the more science has learned about the universe, the more it realizes what it doesn't know. And the fact that there's dark matter and dark energy out there that are completely mysterious opens up the door for new kinds of theories and new kinds of experimental explorations. So it really shows that there is much to be done in science, and science is certainly not a done deal. It's something that's evolving and something that can draw young people in to solve the new questions of the 21st century.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Paul Halpern. He is the author of the book Einstein's Dice and Schrödinger's Cat. And I wanted to ask you, Paul, if you talk about the relationship between these two great physicists when Schrödinger comes up with what he thinks is his explanation for the question that Einstein couldn't quite get to. It created quite a stir between these two men who had this very friendly relationship, very great brotherly relationship.
Yeah, it was rather shocking for me to find out about this, and also I'm sure it must have been for Einstein when in January 1947, he suddenly got queries from the press, from the New York Times and other outlets, asking him what he thinks about the fact that Schrödinger beat him to his own theory, to coming up with a solution. And Einstein looked at it and said, hey, wait a minute, this is just math. This is not even a real theory. And was really dismayed. And Einstein responded by just thinking that the press, particularly the press that was believing in this, was jumping the gun and thinking that just because somebody comes up with a theory that it's correct. And he had a lot of critiques of this. And it created quite a stir for some time in early 1947. A number of magazines, Time Magazine, mentioned it, and international newspapers. And it almost was seen as kind of a fight between the weathered senior scientist Einstein and then a junior scientist, although Schrödinger wasn't so junior, a bit younger than Einstein, but he wasn't as well known. And they thought, well, maybe he can catch up to Einstein. But as it turned out, both Einstein's ideas at the time for unification and Schrödinger's ideas were mathematically incorrect and disproven a few years later, which gave the opportunity for Einstein and Schrödinger to kind of make up and to kind of laugh about it a little bit. And luckily, by the time Einstein died in 1955, he and Schrödinger were back in contact again.
Well, scientific collaboration at that point was fragile. In modern day, you know, scientific collaboration is fundamental, essential, really. And very often you hear about a Nobel Prize being awarded to two or three people who have collaborated on one project. How has that changed over the years? I mean, is that a correct assessment of how scientific collaboration has sort of changed?
I think that the big change has been in experimental physics, particularly experimental high-energy physics, which you'll find papers where you have hundreds and hundreds of authors for some of these projects, like the results of the collider, the LHC at CERN. Many of the key papers have hundreds and hundreds of authors. In terms of theoretical work, that's still mostly done by small groups. That could change, but experimental work requires a lot of people these days.
We've spoken about Schrödinger's cat. Let's talk about Einstein's dice. Einstein said that God doesn't play dice with the universe. I think it was Bohr that told Einstein to stop telling God what to do. Einstein was an atheist, wasn't he?
Well, Einstein had a very special view of religion. I wouldn't call him an atheist. He had a view of God as something equivalent to nature, which equated with the ideas of Spinoza. Spinoza, who was a Dutch philosopher, who thought of God as just natural forces. So Einstein, when he said God, he meant nature, or he meant somehow the perfection of nature. And he wrote articles called Cosmic Religion, where he said we need kind of a new religion based upon looking at science and looking at nature. So that was his view.
Yeah. Paul, you are a physicist. You're a professor. You're a person that looks up into the sky at night. As a curious person, I'm sure you have a lot of questions you'd like to see answered. What one question would you like to have answered that would really mean something to you?
I am really curious about what is the missing material in the universe right now. So it would be very interesting to see if that's true. Also, whether or not the universe is, yes, for one, but I have a couple. The other one is whether or not the universe is truly four-dimensional or if there are other higher dimensions that we can't see.
Yeah, and maybe it was 10 years ago when I took this class when I was back in Boston that they, you know, I was taught at the time that you've got, you know, the large and far apart relativity and you've got the small and close together quantum, and those things aren't really reconciled. The only way to reconcile it is through a whole bunch of math called string theory that calls into play maybe multiple universes. And you have a really good about a half a chapter in your book in talking about string and superstring and all of that. Is that possibly something that would reconcile the two? And what do you think about that?
Well, mathematically, string theory is beautiful, and it eliminates a big problem in quantum physics, and that problem is that many of the theories in quantum physics give you infinite terms. So you do a calculation, and it's like dividing 1 by 0 in a calculator, all of a sudden it says infinity or no answer, and then you think, hey, wait a minute, how did I get rid of these infinities? And there are methods for doing so, for subtracting one infinity from another infinity and getting a finite answer and getting reasonable results in everything except gravity. Gravity, if you try to quantize it, you get infinity no matter what you do, unless you switch to strings. And what string theory does, is say that there's a smallest thing, a vibrating string. So you don't have point particles anymore. You have vibrating strands of energy. And because the vibrating strands of energy have a finite length, no longer do you have to divide by zero, which is the size of a point particle. So instead of dividing by zero, you're dividing by finite numbers, and you're actually getting real results. Now, the big problem with string theory is there's too many results. There's so many types of string theory. There's so many geometries that fit in. And it's an excess of riches, and somehow it means that we need to take all these theories, these disparate theories that almost predict everything, and narrow them down into something that models nature. And the amount of narrowing down that needs to be done is phenomenal. You would have to eliminate literally trillions and trillions of other possibilities to say, well, why is string theory modeling what we actually see today? So some people think, well, that's not really a theory if it kind of predicts everything.
Mm. Wow. That's good heavy stuff to think about.
That's really heavy.
Yeah. Well, Paul Halpern is our guest. His book is Einstein's Dice and Schrodinger's Cat, How Two Great Minds Battled Quantum Randomness to Create a Unified Theory of Physics. And I've got to let you go, but before I do, just... when you talked about that one big question about another dimension, the existence or the ability to prove it, I'm sorry, but my mind just went to Benedict Cumberbatch in Doctor Strange. Did you see that movie?
I haven't seen that one.
Well, you've got to
see it. I like
Benedict
Cumberbatch, though, but I should see it during the holidays.
Oh, absolutely do. John always teases me about my fascination with Benedict Cumberbatch, but he does it so well, and he finds the other dimension, John.
I write her letters, and I sign it Cumberbatch.
Okay.
So that's a good one to see, because it always makes me think what real physicists think about fiction like that, or do they go, they're really onto something.
And I'm still thinking of Buckaroo Banzai, Journey into Higher Dimensions.
That is a spectacular movie.
Hey, I will see that one over the holidays if you see Dr.
Lynn,
Strange.
Lynn, you're going to love this, especially when they're walking down the street together.
Excellent. All right. Well, Paul Halpern, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, John. Happy holidays.
Thank
to you,
Paul.
Too. Thanks for having me on.
And we'll be back after these words. It's Cool Science Radio.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, Park City resident and KPCW fan. Our practice specializes in offering a wide array of solutions for knee and shoulder problems. More information is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Want to thank our guest today, beginning with Mark Sunday, the Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President at Oracle, and also Paul Halpern, who wrote the book Einstein's Dice and Schrodinger's Cat, How Two Men Battled to Create a Unified Theory of Physics. Want to also thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. It's KPCW.